Oh, it's such an honor, Danny, to be a part of this amazing podcast you're doing here. And it's just really cool to be talking about this book.
You know my work and you've given it a lot of thought, and I don't normally get such good questions, to be honest.
That was so fun.
Yeah, it sure was, especially the quiz. Thanks for preparing that for me.
Thank you for your wonderful questions.
Best when these things just turn into a conversation.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. Yeah, you obviously got the book.
Good on you for fighting the good fight too.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
I love your enthusiasm. I just think it's a brilliant thing you're doing, a podcast about, you know, books, and you do a lot of great interviews, so I'm really honoured to be part of it.
I so enjoy listening to the podcast. I truly, I love it.
You're listening to Words and Nerds Podcast with Danny V.
I'm so excited to welcome Jack Heath to the podcast for a second time, best-selling author of children's books, including the Danger series, Liars, the Pharaoh Files, and many more. Today we chat about the novel for adults, Hunter, the follow-up to Hangman, a psychological crime thriller that is not suitable for children, and neither is this episode. Jack's main character, Timothy Blake, is pretty dark and may make people a little squeamish. This episode, however, is so much fun, and I hope you enjoy it.
It's such a great pleasure to have you back. I love having guests back again. So welcome back. And we get to talk about a new book too.
We do. Yeah.
Hunter, follow up to Hangman. Yeah, it's fantastic timing. Look, last time we went on some Jack Bauer tangents.
We did.
Which was great. I think we may have exhausted that particular tangent. So we'll see where we go from here. I'm not sure we could do any more quizzes, but I've got a pop quiz for you later on. So
yeah, okay.
We'll see how well you can think on the spot.
All right, cool.
Cool, thinking known. And you're such a diverse writer for both children and adults. And as an artistic person, I was thinking, is it kind of like you were writing kids' books and then you had this dark side, like Timothy Blake, that you wanted to explore, but through literature?
Yeah, well, I think I've been writing for kids and for adults for, you know, more than 10 years, really. It's just that I've only recently managed to get the adult stuff published. So it's not like I've made any kind of switch, but I do think that there are things that you can't really talk about in children's literature without fear of... So I think everyone probably has a dark side. I hope it's not just me. But certainly there's things where you wouldn't want to say them in conversation with another person.
When you first meet them.
Yeah, yeah. Or even after you've known them for a while, necessarily. But putting it in fiction, in fact, specifically putting controversial opinions into the mouth of a cannibal, then that's something you can easily distance yourself from and back off.
It's not me, it's the character.
Yeah, yeah. Right? It's hard for me to give you an example without defeating the purpose, because I'm obviously not comfortable talking about the things that I decided to put in. But a pretty safe example, I guess, is Timothy Blake in this book says some things about university education and how he thinks it's basically just a waste of time and money that is used as a scam to enforce the class system in the USA. So I could explore that idea, but also have the woman he's talking to, Reese Thistle, mount objections to that and say, actually, I learned a lot in college. I made a lot of friends for life. So, in the end, they're both right in a way, but it's very difficult to write an essay or to make a statement with all the necessary caveats that means you feel like you have to be on one side or the other. Whereas with fiction, you can explore all the sides at once.
Yeah. Last time we spoke, you said you had some things in common with Blake, but you kind of amped them up to the next level. Yeah. Is it true for this novel as well, Hunter?
Oh, I should have listened to the last episode that we did to try to remember what... Yeah, yeah, Blake is fairly autobiographical, just in the sense that I think most people wish they were a little bit different to what they are like. Mm-hmm. So I guess, everyone has flaws, but some of us are aware of our own flaws but don't have the willpower to fix them. And so Blake is that amped up to the nth degree. But in particular, so the choice of a cannibal for the main character, that's an exaggeration of what a lot of people have with their diet, I think. Mm-hmm. There is no more common example of people deciding to be one kind of person and then ending up being a different as there is when you decide, oh, I'm going to go on the 5-2 diet, or I'm going to quit sugar or something. And then 2 days later, you're just hoovering in donuts when you're supposed to be fasting.
I'll put on Instagram my quinoa salad and eat a donut. Done that before.
Exactly, sure. That. So, and I think it's when you have a bad habit, if it's something that you need to keep a secret as well, then that makes it even harder for some reason, because you're burdened by the need to keep that secret. So that's what Timothy Blake is. He's just kind of an exploration of those ideas of how who we are and who we wish we were are very different people, but knowing that isn't always enough to solve the problem.
And look, he's such a great character. We'll get into it in a minute, but it's just so interesting how you can be so empathetic for a person who does such horrible things, which I'm sure was the intention.
Yeah.
Now look, I'm such a massive Thistle fan. In fact, I want a story from her perspective. I said that if you don't write one, I'm just going to start doing fan fiction.
Would be fun, actually. Someone asked me if I'd written anything for adults that was sort of novella length for an audio only publisher. Whoa. And I was like, I haven't, but interesting.
Fizzle.
I'm open to ideas.
And seriously, it was so great to have her back in the story. Did you always intend to continue the Blake Thistle thread?
Well, Hangman was never supposed to have a sequel. It was supposed to be sort of a standalone. And in the original ending of Hangman, the original ending was a bit happier than the actual ending, without revealing what the actual ending is. He basically kind of realized that he cared more about Thistle than he did about eating people, and he quit eating people in order to be with Thistle, and they all supposedly, apparently, maybe live happily ever after. And that's not actually what happened. With my idea for when I decided to make it into a series, my idea was that Blake would be the only recurring character.
Okay.
It would just be him and a bunch of new people each time, sort of like the Jack Reacher books in that sense. But Thistle was such an interesting character that I didn't want to let her go. And secondly, she is what brings out the most interesting aspects of Blake. Blake isn't really interesting without her, I don't think. You need her as a counterpoint to, like, okay, so you're terrible because you've done all these terrible things, but also all these terrible things have happened to you, so it's okay, except it's clearly not, because all those terrible things happened to Thistle too, and she isn't anywhere near as bad as you are, so what's the deal there? And they kind of bring out the worst and the best in each other.
I think he's still interesting. I just think it gives him so much greater depth because you see that other side of him, that, I guess, more tender side.
I suppose so. So I've written a synopsis for book 3 and sent it off to my agent. They haven't sent it off to the publisher yet.
You just answered my last question.
Oh, right. Okay, great. Jumping ahead. Well, the thing is, I don't know if they'll say yes, so it might be no. But the point is, Thistle is in it. I can't imagine writing a Blake book without Thistle making an appearance.
Well, if you don't write them getting married and Blake doing the catering, that's when my fanfiction's coming in.
I don't think he'd be a very good caterer. I mean, he's not Hannibal Lecter. He's not a foodie. He's just an animal, basically. So he's like,
It'd be very interesting to see what was served.
Yeah, I catered by just kind of stealing a cadaver and plonking it on the table. You guys can serve yourselves. He's that kind of caterer, I think.
And for people who saw on Instagram your wife's cake at your book launch, that was so amazing.
It was grisly.
Yeah, what was the ingredients? What was all the red?
So the red was just a mixture of food. We tried using like raspberry jam blended strawberries and all that kind of stuff. Didn't work. Just didn't look like blood. So in the end, it was like food coloring and corn flour and honey all grouped together.
For their texture.
Yeah, basically to make it have that sort of sticky kind of blood.
What did it taste like?
The blood, not so great. The rest of the cake, really good, though. So no one noticed, I think, how bad the blood tasted, because mostly because the cake underneath it was great.
That is so funny.
Yeah.
Now, we're continuing the conversation about Thistle. It's really important to have people from your past, like in real life, too, because they ground you. And I was saying this to some of my girlfriends the other day. They've seen every version of yourself. You know, they've seen the crazy teenager, the idiot 20-year-old, the, mature 30-year-old. And it's so interesting. I think there's something special about someone knowing you from childhood to adulthood. Do you think that's important for them as well?
I think yes, definitely. With not only these characters, but just in real life, you end up with this kind of well, I guess a reputation that you can't change, but one that is likely to be justified if a person has known you for a long time. So certainly in my own life, whenever I'm doing an interview like this, well, you know me a bit better than an interviewer normally would, so this isn't the best example. But I'm always trying to sound like a genius, so as people will think that the book is a work of genius.
Blow your cover, Jack.
Thank you, I appreciate that. But the point is, if I'm talking to a friend who's known me for 20 years, they're not going to believe any of that. They're like, you're not a genius. I once saw you try to make nachos using cornflakes instead of corn chips.
You're blowing your own cover here.
Yeah, exactly. But also, there's that thing where if a total stranger sees you on your worst ever day doing something terrible, then they are going to outright assume that you're a monster. Whereas someone who's known you for 20 or 30 or 40 years sees you do something terrible, they go, oh, something terrible must have happened to Jack. Just imagine him doing that or saying that or whatever.
Or all the good parts of their scene kind of counteracts that bad day.
Exactly. Yeah. So with Blake and Thistle, basically everyone who knows Blake as an adult, they don't all know that he's a cannibal. In fact, very, very few of them do. But they still think he's, you know, worse than dirt. Like, likes him.
Yeah.
Whereas Thistle, at least having grown up with him and then lost touch, she sort of sees the child that he was and now the man that he is, and is willing to accept that there's something more under the surface and maybe not completely irredeemable. Yeah.
And of course in Hangman you find out something really awful about what happened to his parents too, which I think was really pivotal in who he became perhaps.
I'm interested in sort of that predestination type thing, like if he was always doomed to be the person that he is because of that, or if he could have risen above it.
Yeah, and it's such an interesting thing to explore, because I don't know that we have the answers.
No, you know? That's right. A question that is answerable.
Unanswerable.
Yeah, if it's
answerable.
But they're
the most interesting, right?
That's right. You don't want to write a book about a problem that can be solved.
Unless you just Google it and it's solved and you're done.
Exactly. There you go.
But without giving too much away with Hunter, the only way forward, I think, for Thistle and Blake
is if please write book three for me.
Well, just stick to fan fiction. I feel like Thistle needs to have some dark secret too, you know? Does she have a dark secret? You're not going to tell me, I know, that's okay. But before you begin, I feel like you foreshadowed it a little bit in Hunter when, I think it was her ex-husband said, she has a cold streak, you'll see. I was like, oh, are they both cannibals? Are they both going to be chowing down on criminals?
Oh, that would be a great twist, except that I feel like it would probably ruin the premise of the idea
might
that...
Might be a bit too over the top.
Yeah, maybe, or rather, if she turns out to be, you know, as monstrous as him...
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, it might make them fit together better, but the ethical conundrum at the heart of the book about whether you are who you are because of whether you have free will or not, that would kind of destroy that facade. I'm assuming, so it's not spoiling too much to say I don't know what dark secret Thistle might have, like the characters are not real people, I make them up as I go along. I suspect she does, like we all do. I would also suspect it wouldn't be as bad as
and that's what Blake. I was trying to think of what is equivalent to cannibalism. I don't know.
Yeah,
I didn't come up with anything, I'm sorry. I'll keep thinking.
But that's okay. I mean, there's plenty of other... I mean, I've read lots of great crime novels recently where, you know, the main character has some kind of fatal flaw, or they're keeping some awful secret. And it's never anything anywhere near as bad as what Blake is keeping, but it's still compelling.
Yes.
So I think you could write a compelling story from Thistle's point of view, even if she doesn't eat people.
Absolutely.
That's my
absolutely.
Hypothesis.
And I think so too, because I think there's still so much to explore with her. So I hope book three comes... As do you.
Working on it. Yeah, that's right.
Now, do you think for someone like Blake, with his childhood trauma and who he's been mixed up with and his desire for cannibalism, do you think there's a way out for him?
Oh, I've thought of a bunch of different ways that the story might end. Like, if there's a sort of series arc. So you could have, you know, option one, he dies. Option two, he ends up in jail. Option three...
The wedding. The red wedding.
Yeah, well, you can combine some of these, in fact. It would be a red wedding. So option four is he somehow manages to kick the addiction and lives happily ever after.
Or she accepts the addiction.
Something like that. And then they keep going, like, you know, Dexter season two. Although, if I remember correctly, that didn't work out well for Dexter.
No.
So I don't know if there's a a way out for him, but I do know that the reader is unlikely to, part of the trick of this series is, you know, manipulating the reader into feeling sympathetic towards this monstrous person. Mm-hmm. And I think a big part of that is the fact that he doesn't get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
So if either Hangman or Hunter had a happy ending, I think people wouldn't be talking to me so much about how much they love the character of Blake. I think they would find him a bit harder to forgive if he managed to find a way out.
So yeah, maybe we'll see. Right. Even though all the way through I was, I don't know, kind of wishing for at least an above average ending.
Yeah.
I found it really odd always being on his side, you know, going, oh, come on, Blake, find a way out or find love or whatever it was. And he commits some of the worst crimes you could possibly imagine, and it, like we said, it's obviously your intention for him to be an empathetic, likable character. You want that for the, you know, the main character of your book.
Yeah.
Was it a difficult balance for you, and how did you manage to pull that off?
Yeah, it's like a constant tightrope, and I think the trick is just showing it to lots of other readers along the way in the early stages, and a variety of them, and listening to what they say about, oh, I feel like you've gone a bit too far here, or this part, would he really do that kind of thing. So I always try to push too far and then rein it back, because that's easier than not pushing far enough and then pushing it forward. But we talked a lot in the last episode about Jack Bauer, and I think it's the essentially the same thing. He does a lot of terrible things over the course of the series, but because he suffers so much and it's
for the good of humankind.
Exactly. It's walking that exact same tightrope. So I guess a big part of what I'm doing here is instinctive, because so many of my favorite series are like that. They're 24 or Dexter or whatever. The examples of where the appeal of the story is watching the hero do something where the audience goes, oh no, are they going to be able to come back from this? You know, Buffy and Angel.
And should they come back from it? Because like you said, Jack Bauer does some terrible things too, but you know, then it's always for the greater good, I guess, from his perspective.
I've just been reading Injustice, the graphic novel or comic series by Tom Taylor, who's an Australian author. I'd be interested to hear an episode with him on the podcast if you're taking suggestions. But it's the same thing, only it's Superman. Like at the beginning, Lois Lane is murdered by the Joker, and then Superman murders the Joker, and then very, very, very slowly becomes a despot or a dictator. Mm-hmm. So, and he's always trying to do the right thing, and he's Superman, so you instinctively like him. But the further the story goes, the worse his encroachment on other people's freedoms get. And so, yeah, I guess I just gravitate towards that kind of story.
Well, they're interesting. And I was thinking with Blake as well, like for him, cannibalism, it's almost not a choice, is it? It feels like a compulsion or an intrusive thought.
Yeah.
And I think that helps him become morally ambiguous as well.
I think so. I don't know to what extent we have choices really, and how much is just determined by our circumstances and our biology, but you would have heard the expression that everyone has a price. You know, there's something you would, for whatever thing you don't want to do or wouldn't normally do, someone could offer you a given amount of money and you do it. I don't think everyone has a price. I think everyone has a currency. Mm-hmm. I think there's some certain thing for which you would do absolutely anything else for. Yep. And so in Blake's case, Hunter begins with him being presented with something that he can't resist, which is a freshly dead human body. He's like, okay, there are so many reasons for me not to take a bite out of this guy.
Yeah, so many.
Just one. What harm could it do? And then the harm it does is the remaining 400 pages of the book.
Look, it might have been okay in the 50s when there was no DNA, but today you can't do that.
That's right. This is an aside, but writing cop dramas is so hard now with all the technology they have at their disposal. I really wanted to write old school noir type stuff, but that's difficult in a world where there are mobile phones and DNA testing and all that stuff, and social media feeds where you can just kind of scroll through the last known hours of the victim. There's a line in the book, I think, about a modern trade-off, because now these days, if you have the suspect's phone, you know everything about him, but if you don't have it, you know nothing at all, because they don't keep diaries.
Blake says, I can't take another bite. Misery seeps in, like the cold drafts under the doors. Just after a meal is the worst time. That's when I'm not eating or looking forward to eating, so I have nothing to distract me from what I am. And look, we're not all cannibals, but we all sometimes have that sense of self-loathing, or we can't escape from ourselves, or we're not good enough. And I think we can all relate to that. Maybe that's why we can relate to Blake as well.
Yeah, I think so. Everyone's done things that they're not proud of. Mm-hmm. And that specific eating thing, I think we probably recognize that specific moment. Like you've had lunch, maybe it was a really heavy lunch, and you go like, that was what I was looking forward to, so now how am I going to feel the rest of the day?
Now, there are many threads in crime fiction, and Hunter's no exception. How do you keep them all straight in your head and ensure you wrap them up at different points in the book?
I've only recently started becoming an outliner. Mm-hmm. I used to sort of make things up as I went along, and now I have to write an outline to get the publishing contract in the first place anyway, so... and I've found that the outlining really helps because you start to see plot holes before they appear and it makes the editing easier. But also, I never really stick to the outline. Hunter, so Shannon Luxford, who's kind of the villain that that Blake is chasing for most of the book, he was not in the outline. I don't just mean not his name, I mean not the character.
Not at all.
It said in the outline, chapter 2, Blake visits the university. He exposes some kind of crime while there, revealing his genius, but it turns out to be unrelated to the main plot. That's all it said. And then when I had to come up with something that Blake could expose there, there was this really interesting character of Shannon Luxford getting away. And I went, well, given that it would make sense for Blake to think that he was the killer, Blake's got to pursue him now. So then... the whole book became about him, kind of. Mm-hmm. So the outline is mostly just a safety net.
Yeah.
But you were talking about the various threads that you've got to knot together. I guess every chapter needs to stand on its own 2 feet. Mm-hmm. And so that means that whenever I was writing a chapter and it seemed a bit boring, I threw in some extra crime or complication or thread, and then I had to remember to deal with it later, as you said. But it helps to have good copy editors and also just to have done this a lot before.
And I guess the publishers would expect that you're going to come up with new stuff as you go along.
Yeah.
And they're going to expect you're going to drift from the outline a little bit.
Yeah, that's right. I apologise to my publisher, Jane Paul Freeman, who also publishes... Chris Tolkis and some other great authors, but she was one of the original mad people who thought the Hangman book could work. And when I apologised that Hunter was so different from the outline, she said, "I don't read them." So I'm like, wow, enough.
Her secret's been revealed.
Problem solved. Yeah, live on
air. At least it was kind of like, okay, they've got an outline, they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Tick a box.
They have an opportunity to read it and go, oh, this isn't going to work at all. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I guess having already had Hangman, there was some faith that...
Yeah, well, yes and no. I mean, the ending of the original Hunter outline was different too. And it was my agent objected to the outline. And as I was writing the book, I was like, oh, well, you've just told me you don't think the ending's working, but I know it sounds dumb, but I promise you, by the time I get there, just have a little faith. And then as I was writing it, I started thinking what my backup ending would be. Okay. And then my backup ending turned out to be better than my main ending, so I just wrote that instead. The original ending never got written.
Okay. That's interesting too, because I think as you go along, you'd start, you know, getting to know your characters more, and it probably often leads you to something different.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. They start to make their own decisions after a while.
Yeah. Now, I have a few questions from Twitter from Rachel Veach.
She's been very supportive on Twitter. Hi, Rachel.
So many questions. She's almost a co-host. Yeah. The first thing she wants to know is the strangest thing you had to Google search while writing Hunter. And I want to know if this gives you a free pass at home to look up anything you want. You can just pass it off as research.
I was concerned when I was typing in, like, poisons that are tasteless. That, you know, someone would be concerned about that watching my Google searches.
As long as it's in your book, right? You're fine? It's your alibi?
Well, you've got to make sure it stays in the book. But also, I forget if I told you this last time, because this was Hangman research, not Hunter. But I was like, this wasn't a Google search. This was on Facebook. I posted, okay, Brains Trust, if I wanted to poison someone... and then eat the body without poisoning myself, what could I use for that? And
great question also.
Guess who gave me the answer? Nick Earls. Dr. Nick Earls is like, here's what you want. You want succinylcholine, like it'll work as a paralytic, you know, inject them with the right amount. It works if you miss the vein, it's intramuscular.
Wow.
I'm like, you are a creepy man.
Rachel also asks if you've had any weird Google ads.
It's not too bad, actually. So I use a lot of ad blockers. I'm still not sure about the ethics of ad blockers. So I don't see a lot of targeted advertising, especially since on my Facebook profile, like, I click like on a whole bunch of things I'm not actually interested in just to sabotage the algorithms. Yeah. I'm pretty paranoid, really. But certainly I get a lot of ads for, like, travel to Texas and I get a lot of stuff about Texas news, you know, when the algorithm's guessing what I'm interested in. So there's an awful lot of stuff about the death penalty, anything that's going on in Texas, and so I get targeted in that way. But that just makes future books easier to write, so not complaining.
Going off on a complete tangent here, I've had this conversation with a couple of people about they've actually said something with, you know, their devices on them, but not actually Googled it. And the next day they've had an ad. Like my friend, she mentioned this type of beer, and this is going to the paranoid scheme. I don't even know if this is a real thing. And then she started getting ads for all this beer.
Yeah.
The other day, right, my husband mentioned something about Transylvania. We get home, and on YouTube, it's like, watch this Transylvanian YouTube clip. And we're like,
yeah.
Do you think this is a thing?
I think so. It could well be. I had this exact same conversation with your former guest, Andrew Hutchinson, who knows more about social media than anyone else I've ever met. And one of the things...
Andrew, help us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is this a thing or am I paranoid?
I don't want... Andrew, chime in the comments and let me know if I'm paraphrasing you too much. But he argued that the amount of sort of bandwidth and computation it would take to be listening to you all the time, while it's technologically possible, it doesn't make economic sense. But my example to him was, I was like, oh, my friend had been, we were doing yoga together and he said he had a problem with anterior pelvic tilt or something. And I'd never heard of that.
Specific.
Yeah. And then later YouTube on my phone started suggesting videos for how to fix anterior pelvic tilt.
Can't be a coincidence.
No, but Andrew said, so your friend probably Googled it and then you two were in the same room and your phone knows that. And the phone definitely knows we know each other because we're in each other's contact lists. Mm-hmm. So it's seeping through that way, possibly.
Can you explain Transylvania to me, please, Andrew?
Yeah, definitely. Get in touch.
We watched it, actually. We watched Village Life in Transylvania.
All right. Yeah. Oh, I was picturing Hotel Transylvania. Okay, well, something completely different.
Well, we were talking about vampires in Transylvania. That's how it started. But we got home and we watched Village Life of Transylvania.
Yeah. Just another aside. Why is cannibalism so... so taboo when vampires are so mainstream?
Right? Like,
the Hunter and, well, not so much Hunter, but Hangman is basically just Twilight.
It's just a vampire.
Right?
It's, I never thought about these before.
It's Twilight except Bella Swan doesn't know, I guess.
Yeah. Mm. And it's acceptable if you're a vampire because vampires are kind of cool and sexy, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Lost Boys is my, you know, go-to point for vampires.
There's Kiefer Sutherland again.
He always comes. We weren't going to talk about Kiefer Sutherland. And look, he just keeps coming back.
He does.
I've heard you read in a thick Texan accent before. Are you going to do it again? Because Rachel wants to know that, do you write it with a thick Texan accent in your head?
Yeah, I don't. So I write kind of more quickly than... So I read my work aloud as I go from time to time, often when I feel like I'm stuck or when I'm not sure if Blake would say that.
Yeah.
So yeah, I can do a reading. My Texan accent's pretty shonky. Or rather, so I like to think it's better in my head than it is in real life. But also, if you want to hear the book with a proper Houston accent, there's a guy named Christopher Ragland who reads the audiobook and he's fantastic.
I will have to listen to that.
So this bit goes, Houston's waking up now. The roads are getting crowded. Drowsy office workers going one way, petrol chemical engineers the other. Soccer moms taking surly kids to school. Long lines at every drive-through, headlights blurred by the haze of exhaust. Drivers exiting with huge throwaway coffee cups in their hands and mouths already full of bacon. The radio shouts at me, on and on, like it's afraid I'll fall asleep at the wheel if given half a second of quiet.
I love it.
That's what he sounds like,
Rachel,
in my head.
That's for you.
Yeah, thanks, Rachel.
Especially for you. I think I've heard you do it on Instagram. You had this live story. And I was like, this is so great.
Oh, yeah. I did one particular reading. I promised I would if Hangman got into the Dimmicks 101 Club, the 101 best books of all time as voted by Dimmicks
what
readers.
What have you promised this year, Jack?
So I said if Hangman or Hunter got back into the 101 Club, I would eat some human flesh. And I'm not kidding, because my wife offered to donate her placenta for the purpose.
Totally acceptable.
Supposed
thing
to be very good
apparently
for you.
Apparently meant it's, to be very good for
it's
you.
It's not illegal. It would be great research.
How are you going to fry it, bake it, raw, sushi, schnitzel?
If it's safe, I'll take a bite out of it raw and then try to work out how to make it.
You are hardcore.
Well, it's what Blake would do.
It is what Blake would do. I think schnitzel it.
Schnitzel?
Yeah.
It's not bad.
If
you
schnitzel it, it'd be like anything's delicious with schnitzel, right?
You know, if you crumb it using mayonnaise instead of eggs, mwah.
Really?
Yeah, I discovered that the other day.
It's now a cooking show. Now, you love reader participation. You had people send you riddles. And Shannon Luxford, we talked about him. He used his name. He was the winner of a competition. And then you made him this villain. That is like a dream come true.
Yeah, I did. I'm still not sure if I regret that exactly. It'll depend on how the reader feedback goes. But yeah, I'm always in need of new names. So I basically just said, hey, does anyone want your name in Hangman 2? Because I need new names. If it sounds like the right kind of name for the character, I'll use it. And then I came to my senses and hit like edit really quick. I'm like, be warned, your namesake, something terrible will happen to them, or they'll do something terrible to someone else, or probably both. It's
warning.
So yeah, but Shannon Luxford volunteered his name, and it was such a good name for the character, so I'm like, okay, you have become, and again, he was supposed to be quite minor, but he became the main villain for the thing. So I was enormously relieved when the real life Shannon Luxford posted a 5-star review on Goodreads, because I'm like, phew, he could easily have been very offended by being that character.
Great. I think if your name is used in a novel, you want to be the greatest villain. You don't want to be the shopkeeper.
These days, authors are expected to be very open with their readers and connect directly to help sell the books, basically. I'm not convinced that that's a good idea, because I think the more you know about the author, you start to hear the author rather than the character when you're reading the books.
We had this discussion, didn't we? We caught up with Andrew Hutchinson.
I think so, yeah. Mm. So another way, so I like to try to connect with the readers in a way that doesn't require me to reveal anything of myself. So asking them for riddles and for their names and things like that means they get to be a part of the process, and hopefully they'll still buy the book, but their enjoyment of the book is not compromised by knowing that I'm not a genius and I'm really just kind of...
We didn't blow your cover, Jack. We're still saying you are a genius.
As a creative writer, someone like who aspires to write, knowing things about the author and their personal life can be extremely valuable. But I think as a reader, it can compromise your enjoyment. Having said that, though, learning to write also assists your enjoyment of reading.
Yeah,
so this is a blurry line, and there's clear solution to it.
I think it's individual, too, because I know myself as a total book nerd. I love knowing everything.
Yeah.
Tell me everything. Now, because you're not busy enough, you developed a board game.
Yes.
How did this come about? Please tell me about it.
Well,
next time we catch up, we'll have to actually play it.
Yeah, that'd be fun. We could do that for your 200th episode. So the board game started out as a creative writing exercise where basically I would get kids to name a character from one book or movie or TV show or whatever, and then a setting from another and a plot from a third, and we would combine that into a blurb. So if they said, 24, The Hunger Games, Harry Potter, then what we have is a counter-terrorism agent has to participate in a televised fight to the death at a magical school in a secret part of England. So then we put that up in the blurb, and then I would get kids to write a scene from somewhere in the middle of that story, and then we'd all read our scenes and workshop it. And that worked so well that I was just mucking around with a deck of cards one day, because I have an interest in magic tricks as well. And I was noticing how many of my DVDs and Blu-rays on the shelves had two-word titles, like Fight Club and Panic Room, and I started kind of rearranging these titles, so you got like...
Panic Club.
Oh,
I don't want to be a part
Fight
of Panic
Room.
Club.
Yeah.
Panic Club sounds scary.
Yeah, or indeed like Fight Club and Club Fight, sort of very different movies. Mm. And so I started just writing down words on a deck of cards and reshuffling them to make cool names, like Orphan X plus Resident Evil equals Resident X, and you're like, what would that be about?
Evil Orphan.
Yeah. Yeah, and so, Evil Orphan, totally. In fact, I think the movie Orphan is Evil Orphan.
Excellent.
I've always liked making games, so I turned it into a game with some index cards and gave it to my friends, and we played it, and we started including, actors instead of characters and pitching them as movies. And that was so much fun that someone said I should put it up on Kickstarter, so I did, and then it... it went gangbusters, and great. I have spent the last couple of months since then trying to deal with that. So I'm like, okay, I've got to talk to printers. I've got to deal with the post office. I've got to buy a huge, huge roll of bubble wrap, like one of those ones that's kind of as big as a microwave.
What's it called?
Oh, sorry. It's called Lights, Camera, Pitch.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. You know what? I'm going to have to order one, Jack, because I want to play it. And you know what? I could use it as a writing exercise. Because you just said you don't want to reveal anything about yourself, I've got 5 quick hot seat questions that are going to make you reveal things about yourself. Feel free to lie.
Great. Oh, fantastic.
No one will know.
Excellent. That's what I'm good at.
Or you can answer them as Timothy Blake if you want.
Okay.
All right, you ready?
Yep, ready.
Okay. What's something you wouldn't do for $1 million?
I wouldn't eat a person.
Ah, good answer. And that's not Timothy Blake.
Although placenta. But, you know,
it's not like a lung.
Yeah.
It's not going to impact anyone's life.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Because the baby doesn't need it anymore.
Exactly.
Right? Cool. All
right, harmless.
And you're mainly vegetarian, right?
Yeah, that's right. Although, like Blake, every now and again, I can't help myself. Just can't help
what's
myself.
What's the meat that you can't help yourself with?
Is Bunnings sausage.
Really? Yep.
Sausage sizzle at Bunnings. I just smell it on my way out and I'm like, I try not to eat meat. I know all the ethical reasons, all the environmental reasons, but Bunnings, gee, that smells sausage. Good. And it's for a good cause. They're raising money for the Canberra Spinners and Weavers Society.
So true. See, I think for me it'd be bacon.
Bacon? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, crispy bacon.
Mm.
Yeah. Quick
fire questions.
Never quit. Greatest fear that isn't losing loved ones.
The world running out of fresh water.
Oh, that's a good one.
It worries me a lot.
Favorite actress?
Milly Obovich, as you well know. As everyone knows.
And thank you for that movie. That was excellent.
Oh, yeah,
so
great.
Great.
The movie we're talking about is called, what's it called?
I can't even remember. It's
A Perfect Getaway.
It was so good. If you haven't watched it, watch it.
Steve Zahn, Milly Obovich, Timothy Oliphant.
Amazing.
Chris Hemsworth.
Yeah, that was a surprise. I didn't know because I love Timothy Oliphant and I was watching it for that and because you said it was a great film and I was like, oh, Chris Hemsworth, such a great movie.
Yeah, totally.
It really is. Who would play you in a movie about your life?
Milly Obovich. She's very versatile.
She's tall too.
Yep, there you go.
She could totally pull it off.
That'd work. And while someone at my son's school said that I looked like the guy from The Flash, a show that I've never seen. I like Google image. So this is the show, not the movie.
Okay,
but I Google image searched and went, oh, you know, maybe. But I don't know if the guy can act. So Milly Obovich, I know she can act. So she can wear a wig.
She's very versatile.
Yeah.
I think she could do it. Milly, if you're interested.
Oh, yeah. Call me.
Now you sound a bit stalkerish, but anyway.
Yeah.
Would you rather be transported permanently 500 years into the future or 500 years into the past?
Having said what I just said about the world running out of water, I still think I'd pick the future. I think on balance things get better. Mm. And I think that for all its strengths, Outlander gives you a pretty misleading view of how romantic and pleasant the past would be.
And
I really like antibiotics and deodorants.
Yes, and the plague is not a thing I really want to come across.
Exactly. We have vaccinations now that aren't just like grinding up scabs and pouring them on you. All that stuff.
Yeah. Well, as usual, Jack, it's been so much fun. We've covered a lot of ground. And I hope everyone loves Hunter as much as I did because I truly, truly loved it. And I really love Timothy Blake. And I'm looking forward to The Red Wedding in the third book.
Thank you, Danny. This has been a pleasure.